This promotional audio recording has been created and funded by Takeda UK Limited and is intended for a UK healthcare professional audience only. Prescribing information for all Takeda products discussed today can be found on this webpage. Adverse events should be reported. Reporting forms and information can be found on the Yellow Card Scheme website, www.mhra.gov.uk/yellowcard. Adverse events should also be reported to Takeda by emailing ae.gbr-irl@takeda.com. Hello to everybody listening. This is another edition of the Talking Transplant podcast from Takeda. And on this occasion, we are reviewing the recent ESOT Congress that was held in London. And I'm really pleased to be joined by a couple of people that were heavily involved in that Congress. First of all, Professor Colin Wilson from Newcastle, who was co-chair of the Congress. Hi, Colin.
Hi, Richard. Thanks for the invitation.
Not at all. And I also have Dr. Romil Ravanan with us from Bristol, who was part of the local organising committee and chair of the infectious diseases sessions. Hi, Romil.
Hi, Richard. Thank you for having me.
Not at all. Really happy to see you both. Let's jump straight in, Colin, if we may, to the main theme of the Congress. Perhaps you can tell us a little bit about this, because I know, linked to this, you rode your bike from Newcastle down to London in the name of sustainability. So tell us a little bit more.
Okay, thanks. So ESOT Conference 2025 in London, we decided right at the outset 2 years ago that this would be about sustainability. And the logo became Nurturing the Sustainable Journey. And of course, when we talk about sustainability, there's a number of aspects to that. First and foremost, environmental sustainability and the climate emergency that we're all facing. And of course, we wanted to focus on that particular aspect around how we deal with these issues that are confronting everyone across Europe and across the world, but of course, from a European perspective. In terms of conferences, the biggest part of a carbon footprint of a conference is travel. And so I came up with an idea relatively early on that I would try and cycle from Newcastle to London. And it fitted in with a number of things happening in my life at that time. So yeah, 6 days, 360 miles. It worked out about 60 or 70 miles a day. Pretty easy, let's be honest, in Lincolnshire, which is flat. Not so easy in County Durham, which is hilly, I can promise you. And Hertfordshire, which was extremely hilly. Who knew? Well, certainly my legs did by the end of it. Yeah, arriving in London for the start of the conference was a good feeling in more ways than one, that I was in one piece, because yeah, a couple of falls, and it's not easy to cycle across a field with a bike with panniers on, let me tell you. But that was an error with Google Maps. Having arrived, we moved straight into the sustainability theme and the opening ceremony. We had some really hard-hitting, impactful presentations, and the conference was set up so that we started off with quite a negative overview of where we are and how we've got to the situation, and watching the temperature, the thermometer, rise around the world to 1.5, maybe even as high as 3 degrees in 30 years. And then as the conference developed, we looked more and more at solutions and ways that we can deal with that. And then finally, we came up with some real world examples of what individual clinicians, allied healthcare professionals can do in their own practice to reduce their own carbon footprint. So yeah, that was the theme that ran through. And of course, we brought in workforce sustainability along the way, which is another major component of the challenge that we're all facing. It's just really difficult with the aging population and more people needing transplantation to keep a sustainable work-life balance and encourage people to be involved in transplant.
Thanks, Colin. For those of you that remember the Saturday afternoon wrestling on the TV, two falls and no submission from the sounds of it with your bike ride.
Yeah.
You talked about the wider element of sustainability, and I know that making the most of every organ is really important in transplant. And there are a couple of things that I think I'd like to introduce at this point. That's patient selection and also incompatible donors. So first of all, let's hear from Adnan Sharif, who I spoke to at the Congress around patient selection.
So it is Tuesday at ESOT, and I'm joined by a speaker that I enjoyed very much listening to earlier in the week. Hi, I'm Adnan Sharif, and I'm a transplant nephrologist, and I work at the Queen Elizabeth Hospital, Birmingham.
Thanks, Adnan. I heard a phrase used in your presentation, which is a good innings. Perhaps you'd like to give us a bit more insight into that and the counter-arguments.
Yeah, so, I mean, in my presentation, I was talking about transplantation in the elderly, and I was looking at whether or not our transplant assessment process is biased against elderly transplant candidates. And one of the arguments that people often make is that younger people probably deserve a transplant more than the elderly. And there's this fair innings argument that everyone deserves to be able to live a decent innings, and therefore a younger person should have greater privileges or access to transplantation than the elderly. And in my presentation, what I was arguing for was that that's not a particularly fair system, and our transplant system needs to be very careful that we give fair opportunity to elderly transplant candidates. And you know, it's not a case that every elderly person with kidney, liver, heart failure is suitable for transplantation, but everybody deserves a very objective assessment for transplantation opportunities. So I think the fair innings argument has been debunked quite nicely, and I think essentially, you know, we need to follow a very egalitarian approach where every transplant candidate needs to be judged on their own merits.
Great. So we've heard from Adnan there. Rom or Colin, any comments from both of you?
Like most presentations by Adnan, fairly thought-provoking and, more importantly, fun, so it's quite engaging. The concept of people either being considered or excluded based on a single variable, I think, is correct to challenge. Like most things, age is a number. Whilst age in general may be associated with more frailty or more comorbidity, that on its own being a deciding factor would be hard to justify in this day and age. So composite scores and doing the risk-benefit calculation for the patient in front of you is probably what most professionals and, more importantly, most patients would want to do. So.
Colin, anything to add on that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I agree totally with Romwell and Adnan that, you know, it needs to be a holistic assessment. It can't just be based on one organ system and saying that because the cardiovascular system isn't 100% that they should be denied transplantation. Of course, you know, this is all part of the big picture of organ utilization and how do you distribute equitably and fairly these scarce resource, which is deceased donor kidneys. And in the UK, we've come up with various ways of doing this in an equitable fashion, including this D4 to R4 program, which trying to prioritize the organs that have probably a limited lifespan to the recipients with a limited lifespan. And Europe has done a similar thing with the Eurotransplant Seniors program as well, recognizing that older patients benefit from transplantation. There's no doubt about that. But making sure that we maximize the resource that we have. And within centers, you're always looking to try and improve the individual patient experience. So there's that kind of high-level strategic overview of how we try and deal with the problem. And then there's the low-level individual patient, which is every clinician's responsibility to make the best use of a limited resource.
Thank you. And of course, one of the challenges to making the most of every organ is when we're faced with the issue of incompatible donors. And Rommel, you made a particularly impassioned presentation on this Congress. So tell us a little more about that, if you would, please.
So human beings in most parts of the world, including UK and Europe, are in general altruistic and they want to help fellow citizens, family members, etc., for the best of humankind. And that's one of the best things that professionals like me or Colin always look forward to seeing, is the best in human nature that quite often comes forward. Now, despite both the person wanting to give an organ and the person wanting to receive an organ wanting to be the best, occasionally nature or biology throws some obstacles in the way. So this might be in the form of blood group, or the person needing the organ transplant may have a very, very fussy immune system. So what we would typically call sensitized, which is a sort of biological veto for the transplant to proceed. And like many countries, the UK, as well as countries in Europe, have tried to tackle this along two main themes. So one is, can you come up with drugs to counter the biological hurdle? And separately, in parallel, can you come up with processes that allow you to better match the donor and the recipient? And I guess the discussion was about, is one better than the other, and which one would you go for? Where are the outcomes? What do the outcomes show between those two parallel processes? And like most things in life, this particular problem needs a suite of solutions. It's not that any one solution is good enough, and having multiple solutions is probably the way to go. Specifically, as far as Europe is concerned, because of the ethnicity and the diversity of the HLA types, these are the fingerprints that are present on every cell that allows immune systems to recognize something as being the same or foreign. The diversity of the population in Europe lends itself, as well as the geography, as well as like-minded people, both citizens and professionals, lends itself, in my view, to having a kidney exchange program involving one or more countries that will ultimately be beneficial for all citizens of those countries. Mm-hmm. And very good mathematical modeling work shows that you could increase, with sort of pooling your kidney donor pairs and kidney exchange programs, you could increase your organ transplant numbers by about a quarter to a third. So transplant numbers will go up, so that in turn improves the health of the population. So that's important. Separately, outcomes after such kidney exchange programs are generally better than anything you can do pharmacologically. It possibly also saves the taxpayer some money from. But that doesn't mean pharmacological interventions don't have a place. I think both have a place, and there's ongoing trials of new drugs, which might again change things in the future. But there's a role for all of these solutions to achieve best outcomes for the patients in front of you.
Thank you. And how far away do you think we are from being at the pinnacle of transplant exchange programs? Because I know you put something up which sort of said, as you added more countries on, it wasn't just additive, it seemed to almost to multiply through with the more points, more countries that you included.
And also being, I guess, intelligent about which countries you paired with, because the more the genetic diversity, the better the chance of matching. How close are we? So the good news is EU-funded program on the Euro Kidney Exchange program, which started in January 2025, has some of the best brains in the business from 17 different organizations, multiple countries. So this group of people, they've come together because they're quite passionate about making a change in this field. So the website, EuroKEP, is probably the place to go. So I'd probably expect material change within the next 5 years or so. There are some legislative and regulatory barriers that need to be overcome, but I'm confident this group of people are the right people that can help us overcome the barriers.
Good news. Good news. Thank you. Colin, you mentioned when you were talking about sustainability, also that it's about sustainability within the workforce. And with the use of multidisciplinary teams, that brings in people from many different roles. It was really great to see a pharmacist presence at ESOT. And I had the pleasure of speaking to Hafer Lister from Harefield. So let's hear what she had to say.
Today is Wednesday, which means it must be nearly going home time from ESOT in London 2025. But I'm standing with the Solid Organ Transplant Pharmacy Association people on their stand. And there's somebody here that I'm really looking forward to talking to.
Hi, this is Hafer Lister, consultant pharmacist in cardiothoracic transplantation based at Harefield in London, and also here representing SOTPA at ESOT.
Thanks, Hafer. Great opportunity for you guys to be here. What's your take on ESOT from a pharmacist perspective?
I think it's been very, very interesting. And having ESOT this year in London has meant we've managed to gather a group of people. I think this is the largest pharmacist contingent of about 20 plus. Having the booth, thanks to ESOT's leadership, we've managed to also make contact wider than Europe with pharmacist colleagues in the Middle East and in Southeast Asia with Vietnam as well. So I'm hoping this will enable more pharmacists to get involved in transplantation and our partnership with ESOT to grow so that we can co-sponsor webinars and symposiums going into Prague in 2027.
So that was a useful and interesting bit of insight from Hafer there. Rommel, Colin, any thoughts on the role of pharmacists or the broader utilisation of multidisciplinary teams in transplant?
SOCPRA I've been very aware of. I had the pleasure and privilege to be involved with this organisation when I was General Secretary of the British Transplant Society, and they very much came into the fold as part of the wider MDT within transplantation. And we were very keen to bring them on board there. And so, yeah, it was a natural extension being part of the European Society of Organ Transplant Conference as well. This is such a key part of the transplant experience is medication. It's the universal experience of everybody who has a transplant is to have to take tablets and manage these medications. And we're incredibly reliant as healthcare professionals on the expertise of pharmacists to ensure that they're on the right medications and they're taking them in the right way. I was lucky enough to be involved in one of the patient sessions at ESOT when one of my colleagues, a physician, stood up and said, "It's incredible how many people do not know how to take tacrolimus," and then pointed at me, and I had to kind of shrink beneath my seat because, you know, this is not something that's within my normal daily experience. But of course, it's the daily lived experience of the patient, and they're incredibly reliant on pharmacists to get the correct advice. So yes, we want them to be part of all of these aspects of the transplant patient journey and guiding us and guiding the patients to the right advice.
Richard, for me, I would say transplantation is the ultimate team sport. So one of the things that attracts Colin and me, et cetera, to this game is because there's something ethereally different where if you win as a team or you succeed as a team as compared to an individual. Like most teams, everyone, I'm a big cricket fan. Sachin Tendulkar, in my view, was one of the best batsmen, but he could bowl, but he was never going to be the best bowler. So for a team to win, you need all of the team players with their different strengths to contribute to achieve the outcome that you want to achieve. And if you take football, clearly the goalkeeper never is going to score the most number of goals, and the forward's not going to do most of the defence. So we all have a role in the team. And pharmacists, as Colin's indicated, have a role that is very difficult for someone else to do. The case in point would be, say, for example, managing someone with HIV disease who also needs a kidney transplant is one of the most difficult things to do, because quite often medications used for HIV don't go very well with medications used for transplant. There's an arm's length list of medications that are used for HIV, and knowing which one interacts in what way with the transplant medications is extremely unlikely I would be the expert in that field. But that patient, the value add from the pharmacist providing their expertise is absolutely key for a good transplant outcome and for good HIV outcome. So yeah, in that sense, the SOCPRA being on board, glad they had a booth at ESOT. As Colin has already mentioned, the BTS have a very good relationship with an increasing number of affiliates like SOCPRA. Nursing staff, I mean, if the specialist nurses and organ donation don't do their job, there are no organs to transplant. If the living donor coordinators don't do their work well, there are no organs to transplant. So, yeah, one of the things that is attractive is the fact that you win or lose as a team. And as a team, you lead a process to the outcome you want to get to.
Thank you, Rommel. If any of our listeners want to send me a message and suggest, out of Colin and Rommel, which one's the tight head prop and which one's the scrum half, please feel free. I'm going to move on, if I may, to another aspect of sustainability, which involves cooperation between the pharmaceutical industry and clinicians, and that's around evidence generation. We've very much moved away from series of multiple RCTs, big random controlled trials, and increasingly we're hearing more and more about making use of data from real world. And that certainly was part of the feature around CMV at ESOT. We heard from the Canada Genome Project looking at the impact of CMV and levels of viremia, really highlighting the fact that if you have any level of viremia for more than 2 weeks, then it's got poor association with long-term outcomes, and equally above around 10,000 international units. We also heard from Nazim Kumar, who presented some real-world data from an analysis of the French Compassionate Use Programme of maribavir. He concluded that the maribavir resistance rate was lower than the findings in the Solstice study, whilst the effectiveness was consistent with the trial findings, with the additional patients who achieved CMV clearance beyond 8 weeks of treatment. So that was reassuring to see some real-world data backing up the trial data. It was also great to hear a presentation from Gareth Bryant from Cardiff, speaking on behalf of the UK Renal Pharmacist Group, looking at UK real-world data with maribavir. They concluded that maribavir is an effective and well-tolerated oral option to treat refractory CMV in an outpatient setting that avoids the associated costs of hospital facilities and reduces the need for nephrotoxic or myelotoxic alternatives. They noted the average treatment duration reflected the reports from the Solstice trial. They also reported that adverse events were similar to the trials and no new emerging resistance was noted. I think it's also important to note that both the French data and the UK data record that there were reactivation rates post-treatment with maribavir, and I guess that implies that there may be a need for retreatment with maribavir. The UK data also concluded that there was a need for preemptive tacrolimus dose alteration, which is again something that's noted in the UK SMPC as a potential issue, and they've noted it as an experience in the UK data. There is more to come, specifically around CMV, and I spoke to Dr. Sapna Shah about that.
Here we are, Monday afternoon at ESOT in London, on the hottest day of the year so far, something over 30 degrees outside, which seems unreal to me, otherworldly almost. But I've got somebody here to talk about real-world data.
Hello, my name is Sapna Shah and I'm a transplant nephrologist from King's College Hospital. So it's great to be here at ESOD and it's lovely that it's in London this year. And there's lots of great CMV presentations, lots of real world data, so fantastic opportunity to learn. Really looking forward to going to those sessions. I'd like to take the opportunity while I've got the mic just to tell you about something very exciting that's coming up. Over the last 18 months or so, we've been working with RADAR, the rare disease cohort, to establish a post-transplant CMV group of patients in the UK, and we'll be looking at outcome after CMV infection, whether it's straightforward infection, whether it's refractory or resistant infection, to see what the impact of that is on transplant outcomes and on our patients. We'll be able to see how we're treating it and what are the complications that we're seeing. So hopefully in the next few months I'll be able to share that data with you, and really nice to see you today, Richard.
Thank you very much, Sapna, and we hope that that data will be available for the BTS Congress in March 2026. So look out for that.
Right, so that was interesting. Exciting news from Sapna about what's coming. And she mentioned that we're looking at getting an abstract submitted for BTS next year. Anybody that's not already booked their ticket to Llandudno or planned a cycling route, do so as soon as possible. Colin Rommel, real-world data in general, what are your thoughts on that? Anything else from the Congress or anything in terms of your experience or indeed what you know is on the horizon?
Oh, thanks, Richard. So I'll just pick up on your Canada Genome Project because I was part of that session, and really interesting data coming out from that study. Paul Keown presented that. The bit that I found very interesting is their experience in patients with delayed graft function and some of the severe refractory disease they've seen in the D plus R negative group with delayed graft function. And there's a number of potential reasons for that, but often these patients are excluded from the randomized controlled trials that you mentioned because they're difficult patients, they're complicated, and there's a number of conflating factors which make them difficult to manage. And so you lose clear messages unless you have huge populations. And they've done a really good job of bringing together a big data set and following it for a significant period of time to get some really significant findings. So yeah, I mean, that was a big take home for me, was that if you're going to give patients antithymocyte globulin on a background of delayed graft function, you've really got to get the valganciclovir dosing correct. Otherwise, you are almost guaranteed to develop refractory resistant CMV. So that was one interesting component for me, looking specifically at real world data.
Richard, from my side, so lots to unpack this. The first, I guess, the question, I think leveraging big data is, I don't know if Colin and I are a generation who missed that boat, but actually, Colin, actually not true. Colin's the boss of AI and actually using data. I think that's the way life is going to go. Again, as a generation, we grew up with RCTs, King, and everything else is no good. And I think future generations will probably pivot away from expecting one thing that is perfection and everything else as being absolutely no good. And big data, especially if it's big, I think has powerful stories to say. And just sort of looking at the NHS 10-year plan, potentially more digital linkages, etc. I think the UK and the NHS specifically has lots to gain and could probably leverage data more than other health economies. So looking forward to that. I may miss the boat, but I'll happily be a very interested spectator seeing that progressing. So I think the using radar has been very, very successful as a program, multiple publications, high impact publications in the Lancet, etc. And radar has the appropriate framework for collecting information on what is rare. And I guess resistant CME would probably fit many definitions of rare. And as you say, roughly 10% likely needing something other than Malgan-Sackler-Wirth is collecting that. Most centers would probably have, I don't know, experience of one or two or three a year. And if you pull that and you get 300, it'll definitely be for the benefit of patients and professionals, potentially influence guideline writing, et cetera, et cetera. So again, looking forward to that happening over the next few days. Within NHS Blood and Transplant, there is a lot of interest in trying to make data work. And amongst the research priorities for the organization, people are being consulted. And I wouldn't be surprised if data science comes out as one of the things people want to prioritize future research on.
Excellent. Thank you both for that. So I think that wraps up some of the stuff. There was so much more that went on at ESOT this year. And congratulations to everybody that was involved in producing a really, really good Congress. I'm not one that likes to wish my life away, but at the same time, I kind of can't wait until ESOT 2027, which will be in Prague. And I know we were talking before we started recording, Colin, that both you and I have had independent conversations with an organization called Transplant2, which is the Belgian organization. I managed to snag one of their cycling jerseys. I think they've suggested to both of us that we join them on a ride from Belgium to Prague for the next Congress. I am not going to pedalo across the North Sea, so maybe we'll get a ferry together. Thank you very much for both of you joining me on this, and speak to you again soon.
Thanks, Richard. Really fun. Cheers.
Thanks, Richard. And again, for your viewers, making a plug for BTS Clandudno, 4th to 6th of March 2026. Please, just for a moment, ignore any travel difficulties that might make you get there. But once you're there, it's an exceptional venue. Great place to be, very friendly. But more importantly, you'll be with friends and you should have a good time when you're there.
Brilliant. We'll see you there as well.